B-Pod Studios.
Today on Talkin' Rock with Meltdown.
It's a big, beautiful book of bass, and the U.S. signing tour starts very soon with Geddy Lee as he answers all sorts of questions today on Talkin' Rock with Meltdown. He talked about bass players he'd interviewed and mentioned one he couldn't get, plus questions from Dave Ellefson from Megadeth, Frank Bello from Anthrax, Johnny Chow from Stone Sour, and what about his future in music?
Well, that's a good question, and one that I ask myself from time to time.
He also talks about his love of baseball and the release it gives him from being a rock star.
Yeah, fantastic. You know, to absorb yourself in the statistical hunt for the great players is always a blast.
And that's just for starters, as far as Rock and Roll Hall of Fame member and Rush bassist Geddy Lee goes, today on Talkin' Rock.
This is Talkin' Rock. Talkin' Rock. Your backstage pass to some of your favorite rock artists. Here's your host, Meltdown.
As always, a big thank you for checking out the Talkin' Rock with Meltdown podcast. I do appreciate it. Man, today, big one, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame member, and of course, bassist for Rush and singer Geddy Lee, man. How cool is this? Really good stuff. We talked to him about numerous topics. Thanks for all you guys, by the way, for giving me some questions online. Like I said in the intro, I did consult with some real true professional bass players. Dave Ellefson, Frank Bello, Johnny Chow all chimed in with some really cool questions as well. But the reason that Geddy is coming to town is he's doing this signing for his book, The Big Beautiful Book of Bass. And Nick from Rock City Music in Livonia is on the line with us right now. And Nick, tell everybody like where they can get their tickets and what the deal is with what's happening on Tuesday, the 16th of July.
So you can purchase tickets for the Geddy book signing at rush.com/Geddy Lee. There's a whole list of dates there, so you're going to want to select the one for Rock City Music on Tuesday. That'll take you to a link to purchase your tickets. Ticket price includes the book and the meet and greet with Geddy, and you're going to get here that afternoon, line up, you get a wristband, get to come right through the line, get your book signed by Geddy. The event runs from 4 to 6:45, and you must have a ticket to attend.
All right, it's cool. Well, I mean, how excited are you guys? I mean, I can practically see your boner over the phone.
We are stoked. We are absolutely stoked. When I got the call yesterday, I couldn't believe it. I just kept saying, this has got to be a joke. This has got to be a joke. And it was not a joke. We are jumping out of our seats here, man.
Yeah, and like he's been doing this at like, you know, Barnes & Nobles and like actual bookstores, you know, but to pick you guys, man, that's really cool. And you got some other events coming up here, and we'll give you a chance to plug those real fast. Nita Strauss coming up on July 20th.
Yep, July 20th, Nita Strauss will be here the same day she's performing with Alice Cooper. That event starts at 1 p.m. Admission is free. And then Monday, July 22nd, we'll have Blackberry Smoke here signing autographs, taking photos with people, and that is also free to attend.
Awesome. Well, I'll tell you what, Geddy did a couple of things, which is somewhat unusual for rock stars. First of all, he called me on a perfectly crystal clear phone line, which is much appreciated, so you can hear every single word and breath he takes. And he called a few minutes early, which is something that a lot of guys don't do. Although I have to admit that about, I'd say 85% of the rock stars I deal with actually do call on time, but none of them really call early, so that was kind of cool. But he called early, and like I said, the conversation's killer. Check it out. It's Geddy Lee today on Talkin' Rock.
Hello, hi. This is Geddy Lee calling to talk to a chap named Meltdown.
Hey, you got him. How you doing, Geddy?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. This is pretty exciting. I don't know if I've ever really talked to you before. Actually, I did a meet and greet with you one time before, and that was pretty cool. But I was thinking about this this big, beautiful book of bass and this U.S. tour and stuff, and I have to admit that, you know, you do a lot of meet and greets and whatnot and stuff like that, but I have to admit that this really brings, like, a whole new level for the fans, for the Rush experience, doesn't it?
Well, it's certainly unusual for me to get to spend time with so many different fans in different parts of the world, and it's really been fun. I didn't expect to enjoy it as much as I have been, and it's nice to get a couple of minutes to meet these fans, and some of them are super young, up-and-coming bass players, a lot of female bass players, a lot of families coming out, so you get little kids and the whole... It's been like a family outing for them, and that's been really sweet, you know?
Yeah, no, that is cool. I was thinking about this. It's like, you know, you travel all, you've been going around the world. Now you're coming to the States to do this. And it's got to be cool that fans from around the world, actually, you can go somewhere in the other parts of the world and people know you and appreciate your music.
Yeah, no, it's really, I've been a lucky dude. What can I say? I've been very warmly greeted wherever I've gone, and there doesn't seem to be a language barrier when it comes to rock and roll, so that's a nice thing.
Yeah. So tell me about this book, The Big Beautiful Book of Bass. I guess one of my first questions I have is, you know, you interview a lot of bass players in this and whatnot, and was there some guys that, you've probably heard this before, was there some guys that you just couldn't get for whatever reason that you wanted to talk to?
Well, most of the guys I reached out to came through. One guy I really would have loved to include it was Paul McCartney, but he was not available. Because there are very few people that are more identified with an instrument than Paul is with his Hofner. So I thought that would be a really nice addition to the Hofner section. We found, you know, a lot of very willing participants and a lot of very interesting cats that we could nerd out with and talk about the origins of the instrument and how they got into it.
Yeah, well, I think when Geddy Lee comes calling, I think a lot of people tend to want to talk to you, I suppose, right?
Well, I wasn't going to be presumptuous. So, you know, I wrote very nice letters to all of them, and they all seemed to respond pretty kindly.
Was there anything that kind of surprised you about any of these guys that you, you know, hadn't known or, you know, took you back?
I think every single interview surprised me, because once you sit down in that environment and start talking about the things that motivated them to start, you know, loving music and playing their instrument and choosing their instrument, there's the requisite stories about their lives that come to the surface. And I found their stories revealing and compelling, and honestly, keeping them at only 4 pages was really hard.
Yeah. Do you remember what actually drew you to the bass at first?
Yeah, I was like most kids in Canada, when they're playing hockey, nobody wants to be the goalie. So they just say, hey, you're going to be the goalie. With me, the bass was kind of the same thing. I was playing in a, it wasn't even a garage band, it was a bedroom band. And our bass player's mother decided that we weren't fit to hang around with, so he was pulled out of the band, and they just looked at me and said, we took a vote, you're the bass player. So that's how I started.
That does seem to happen sometimes. Yeah, it's funny you bring up goalies, because I was supposed to play hockey this morning, but because I'm talking to you, I had to cancel, and I actually texted the goalie, who's a friend of mine. So yeah, I have to talk to Geddy Lee. He goes, while I'm disappointed in your priorities, I'd like to thank him for keeping you off the ice. So there you go. So
sorry about that, man.
You know, it's funny, whenever I get a chance to talk to a bass player, I text some of my other bass player friends, and David Ellefson wanted me to know, and I don't understand what this question means, so maybe David Ellefson from Megadeth. Okay. Do you know David?
I've never met David, but I know who he is and have proper respect.
He says, does he prefer the guitar neck on top of the bass neck or vice versa, and why?
Oh, on a double neck.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Okay, there you
yeah,
go.
Yeah. No, I prefer the bass up top. Because I'm just more comfortable, and when the neck is a little closer to me, I feel more comfortable playing it. So I'm quite happy to have the guitar neck, which I don't use all that often, just dangling below.
Okay, there you go. Yeah, because I know, like, I grew up in Buffalo, and, you know, Billy Sheehan, he does all that double bass stuff as well.
Oh, yeah, he's an amazing player, Billy. Great guy and amazing bass player.
Yeah. Frank Bello from Anthrax wanted to know if he could borrow your Rickenbacker bass for the next Anthrax record.
Okay, tell him to give me a call. We can work something out.
You know, it's funny because I just kind of recently got into bass within the last couple of years, and it's going to sound silly, but that band Ghost, I don't know, for whatever reason, the bass lines are so, like, simplistic, and they just kind of come to the forefront. So I've been kind of training my ear to listen for the bass. And one of the bands I've really fallen in love with in the last couple of years all over again was Yes. And tell me about your thought about playing with them at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Well, Chris Squire was a huge influence on me. He was one of my bass heroes, of course. Chris Squire, Jack Bruce, just to name a couple of these guys, would have been wonderful to meet and actually spend some time with, but I never got the opportunity. But when I heard that Yes had invited me to sit in with them at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, of course I was I was flabbergasted and honored, and especially to play on a song that is really one of the classic great bass songs of all time, which is Roundabout. So I was thrilled, and I went down. The guys were super nice, and they actually played the song more times than they wanted to, just so that I could get comfortable with them. And it was a great evening. It was a great memory, and just sad that Chris couldn't be there to represent as he should have been.
Yeah, going back and listening to that stuff, he was. I have to estimate that he was, just influential to so many bass players.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Chris Squire, John Entwistle, Jack Bruce, those were three of the most influential players of my era. And certainly, I'm sure a lot of other young bass players would agree with that, even this many years down the road.
Yeah, my friend Johnny Chow from Stone Sour is a big John Entwistle fan, and he said he wants to know how you get your sound so aggressive. He says he knows it's your fingers, but to me, players like him and Chris Squire were so monumental in their aggressive tone and approach. What inspired that?
Well, I always liked the guys that had the bass players that had a lot of top end in their sound, but it's a hard thing to wrestle with when you're playing in a band that has a drummer with a lot of cymbals and a guitar player with a lot of top end. You're kind of sharing the same frequencies, so it really requires a lot of experimenting and not giving up on the top end for the sake of the bottom end. You just sort of have to be a little obnoxious and push your way into the sound the soundscape.
Well, you made so many soundscapes throughout the years, and there's different like eras of Rush. It's like some bands they're kind of the same, but you guys had all these different eras, so you were constantly experimenting.
Yeah, I think most artists, most musicians are looking to perfect their thing, to get that perfect combination of feel and playing and dexterity and tone. And it's something that you have to continually work at in order to achieve that thing. And it always feels like you've never really gotten there, but you're on the way and you're getting closer and closer and closer. It's a lifelong thing. I really think that's true with most players.
Now, it's a lifelong thing. And of course, and you haven't played with Rush in the last 4 years. And of course, when I told people I was talking to you, they all want to know, like, what's the future for you as far as music is concerned?
Well, that's a good question, and one that I ask myself from time to time. I spent a couple of years making this book, and I'm really happy with the results, and really happy that people have responded so positively to it. And so I'm going to have some fun traveling around the world and meeting Rush fans and talking to young bass players for a while, and then I guess I'll get home and figure out what the next step is.
Is there a part of you that just, it's been 4 years now almost since you walked off the stage for the last time. Is there a part of you that's like, just itching to get back on stage and play?
Oh, yeah. I certainly miss playing with my bandmates. I was a really fortunate human being that I had such great friends that were also, really cool bandmates. And I was able to play with them for like 42 years on stage. And that was something that's very hard to replace. So I have very fond memories of that. And yeah, every once in a while, I wish I was on stage joking with those guys.
When was the last time you talked to Alex and Neil?
I talk to them all the time. We're still very, very close.
Yeah, that's cool. A lot of people were asking me, too, like if you could just jam with Alex and maybe another drummer, would you do something like that?
That's really hard to say.
Yeah, that's what I figured. We're here in Detroit and Motown and stuff. Did James Jamerson play a role in your bass playing growing up?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would be working in my mom's variety store every weekend, and in the summers up pretty much every day, and we would be constantly driving back and forth from where we lived to the small town where my mom's store was. And the radio was always on, and there was always great Motown songs playing. And without knowing who he was at the time, of course, I was subconsciously absorbing all of James Jamerson's bass lines. So, and when I finally became old enough to be aware of who he was, total respect for his playing and his impact on popular music.
And now, when you were growing up, you were a Detroit Tigers fan, right? Is that true?
I was. That is true. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what drew you to baseball? Because I know you're a huge baseball fan.
Well, when I was a kid, of course, I think the Tigers farm team was here in Toronto, and I remember going down to old Maple Leaf Stadium and watching them play, the AAA team. And then, of course, many, many years later, I would be touring, and I would be waking up in a hotel room at like 2 in the afternoon and begging room service to bring me anything that resembled breakfast, because the hours of a rock and roll guy traveling around are not really easy to manage. So when I would get some food, I would turn on the TV, and in those days there were just the beginning of the superstations, WGN and TBS and all those things, and you could always find the Braves or the Cubs on TV in the afternoon. So I just started watching them while I was waking up, and I really got hooked on the game. And then I started to, on whatever days off I had, I would go out to local parks and try to catch minor league games and major league games, and it just became a magnificent obsession for me and a great distraction.
I was going to say, it's got to be like a release from what you normally do.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Fantastic. You know, to absorb yourself in the statistical hunt for the great players is always a blast.
There's a guy here that owns a record store here in Detroit that has over 4,000 autographed baseballs. He may even have one of you. He's got each Beatle on a separate ball and each Beatle on one ball as well.
Oh, that's really cool. Yeah. That's awesome.
So when you were in Toronto doing your book signing, Dave Grohl was chumming around with you, eh?
Yes, he was.
Maybe you should work with him in the future.
But yeah, you never know. He's a fantastic guy. I love those guys and the foods. And Dave's a very cool guy. And his mom and my mom have actually become pals. And because, his mom, Ginny, wrote this book about rock mom.
Right.
And she flew up here to meet my mom, and they really hit it off. And so they've stayed in touch. And so she was up here doing a talk about her book, and Dave was interviewing her on stage. So they were in town, so we all got together. So it was pretty fun.
That's right. I do remember that. I'm sure the 15-year-old Dave Grohl can't believe that his mom and your mom are friends.
It's pretty unusual. It's pretty surreal, I have to say. We sit there and we just laugh about it.
The Riff turns 50 years old coming up here in a couple of years. We've been asking different rockers and whatnot some of their thoughts maybe of WRIF or Detroit or coming to Detroit for the first time. Do you got any specific thoughts that you remember about WRIF and all your travels and times here in Detroit?
Well, I have so many memories of Detroit, playing in the early days, opening for Kiss at the small theater downtown.
That's right, yeah.
And playing, I think we played every venue from, Cobo Hall through to Joe Louis Arena to when it moved out of town and the Pine Knob. And I just can't tell you how many memories I have of that city. And I remember specifically opening for Kiss and hanging around town for a few days. And it's just a great sense of memories. It was always a great audience in Detroit.
And plus, it's so close to kind of where you grew up, right? I mean, did a little bit of a connection there?
Yeah, well, I had family in Detroit. When I was a kid, I used to come up and hang out with them. And so I was always very aware of Detroit, and it was so close yet so different from
right.
where I grew up. And I must have been at your station I don't know how many times to do interviews over the years.
Yeah. Somebody wanted to know if there was ever an event or decision that may have completely changed the trajectory of your careers. Is there something that you can look back on and say, maybe the 21-12 record or something like that?
Well, certainly, we were sort of headed in the unsuccessful direction until we did the 21-12
record. Right,
right. I think a lot of fans know that story, but we were really struggling on that tour. In fact, we were on the Caress of Steel tour. We were really playing smaller venues, and we were playing with a fellow Michigander, Ted Nugent,
right.
And the both of us were playing small venues and clubs in the South and the Southwest, and it was seeming like our dreams weren't going to come true very in the near future. But then we went in the studio and did 21-12, and it really did change everything for us, and really turned the whole trajectory around.
Do you think that, I mean, what do you think, in your opinion, is like the peak of Rush's career where you guys were really clicking?
I don't know. For me, the last few tours we did, I don't think we'd ever played as well. I don't think we ever had such a complete and versatile, you know, list of songs that we played on stage. So for me, the last, I would say, three or four tours were really magic. You know, we were playing well. We had a great combination of songs and visual effects, and it was just really, you know, what you call the salad days for us. it was a great period.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, Getty, somebody wanted to know, do you start your day off with a friendly voice, a companion, unintrusive? So
no, I start my day off with two coffees and let my dogs out.
Well, listen, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, and good luck on your the big, beautiful book of bass. And I'm definitely going to be picking this up because, like I said, I've just kind of fallen in love with listening to bass. And you know, kind of when you listen to some of these songs, like I was just listening to Crazy Train the other day, a song I've heard, you know, a billion times, and you start zoning in on the bass and it kind of changes everything for you, kind of rediscovering some of these songs, you know?
Well, that's great. I'm really happy to hear that, because one of my secret wishes for the book was that people would understand that the development of popular music has a slightly different take when you look at it from the perspective of the bass player, and the role that the bass played in that development is pretty profound. And it's like, you know, for me, it's my job to reveal that to the public through this big, heavy coffee table book.
Yeah, and it's like sometimes the bass carries the melody, and if you took the bass out of it, it would totally change the song. I guess I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but
yeah, I agree.
Yeah, well, Getty, really great to talk to you. It's a pleasure and a privilege, and good luck on everything, and we'll see you here in Detroit.
Thank you very much. It's nice talking to you too.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
I mean, really, how often do you get to come to work and talk to a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame member like
Geddy
Lee?
Yeah.
So, you a Geddy Lee fan at all?
I respect Rush.
Yeah, some people are like, I get it, because some people, like, Rush can be kind of a divisive band, like,
yeah.
You know what I'm saying? But, I mean, but as players, all of them are, like, so good.
They're amazingly next level.
Yeah.
And there was something, I don't even know how, because I'm not really a big Rush fan. I don't mind Rush, but I'm not really a fan
either. And that's understandable, yeah.
Yeah. But somehow on YouTube, I still stumbled onto a video, and it was like the greatest intro they've ever done, and they just came out and did a bunch of medleys for like 14-16 minutes. And
Rush did?
Yeah, and it was like one of the later shows before they, you know, retired or whatever, but it was phenomenal. I'm not even really a Rush fan. I sat and watched the entire thing because it blew my mind.
Well, as he was saying, like, he really thought that they were really in their groove the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, and really, you know, hitting their musical groove. So that's cool. You know, I forgot to mention to him that one of my things as far as Rush is concerned in my life is it was the first concert I got to take my brother to. So my brother's 7 years younger than I. And this was back in the 90s and stuff, so it was kind of cool. But one of the funnest meet and greets I ever went to.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, and not because it was only Alex and Getty. And so what happens is a lot of these meet and greets, which people may or may not know, is that a lot of times with these bigger bands, you just can't like walk backstage, just hang out with these guys. You know what I'm saying? It's all, you know, they control the whole thing.
Very structured.
Right. And so anyways,
it's almost an assembly line a lot of times.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And so we're in this big square room, and they got everybody kind of against the walls in this square room. And then and then Getty and Alex would stand on one side, and you kind of move along, and they'd take your picture. And they were real nice. You know, I meet Alex Lifeson for the first time. I start talking about Trailer Park Boys. I don't know. I think I just said hello to Getty or whatever it was.
Yeah.
So anyways, but the tour manager comes out and he starts explaining the rules to everybody, right? And it was hysterical. He's like, yeah, listen, Neil's not going to be here because he's got this crocheting project he's doing. Like, he's like making up all this stuff. I'm like,
yeah.
You know, Neil never shows up, right?
Yeah.
He probably makes up a different story in every city, right?
Right.
And so, whoops, you got to shut that off right there. So that's for later.
Yeah.
And So anyways, he starts talking about how, you know, he goes, okay, now listen, when the guys come up here, you got to talk loud because they're old and they can't hear anything. He's like totally dogging them, right?
Yeah.
And then he goes, okay, listen, I'm going to go down and get them. It's going to take me about 5 minutes to walk down there and about 15 minutes for them to walk back. He's like totally giving it to Geddy and Alex.
Wow, that's hilarious.
So I don't know if he knows that or not. I'm sure that they're really good friends.
They have to be in on it. That would be bold if they.
Yeah, right.
You know, if
wait like, a second. The tour manager is saying what?
Suck. And I'm going, oh, they're here. Hey, they're great, everybody. That would be pretty bold.
Yeah. Anyway, so that was a pretty cool Rush meet and greet I got to go to a few years ago and meet the guys. But anyways, really cool of Geddy to join us. And yeah, Rock City Music this coming Tuesday. All the information is on their website. Site and the whole thing. So I have to thank Nick for hooking me up with this great interview with Geddy Lee. So anyways, that's Al Beck. He's got your rock news you can use or not. And today a little bit about the guys from Metallica. Speaking of guys that put on a killer meet and greets, I've been to theirs a lot of times. And most times, most times all four of the guys do show up. Although I went to one in Buffalo and it was just Kirk and Lars years and years ago. But so what do they got going on?
You know, I was thinking about those guys actually yesterday. I like to go walking and stuff, you know, a lot. And I was listening to Master of Puppets.
Oh, great record.
And, you know, you talk about a divisive band. I'm one of those guys. I'm typically an 80s purist. I love the 80s albums.
Yeah.
The rest, you know, kind of in the 90s, I'm not so much or whatever. But you know what? I got to give it to those guys when they play live. They make sure they cover the entire catalog. No matter what era of Metallica you're into, you're going to get to hear what you want to hear, you know, when you see
those
guys.
Yeah, that is interesting you say that because I think the last time I saw them, they do touch on a little bit of everything. Although St. Anger stuff is not there, but you do see it because there's set changes every single show, with the exception of there are some standards that they just play every time.
No, I went with my buddy one time, and we did the if you could hear any song, which would it be? And I came up with like Metal Militia, Fight Fire with Fire, and another deep cut. And he was like, oh, I would love to hear all three of them, but you might get one, but probably not any of them. I said, yeah, I know. Heard all three of them.
Really?
All three of them. Yeah, in Grand Rapids, I heard that.
Yeah, that's cool, man, because, they do change up the set list. But like I said, One, Enter Sandman, stuff like that will always be in there. Yeah. But then they change it around. Yeah. But they got this Murder in the Front Row.
That's right. Yeah, I got a little sidetracked there because I was just thinking Metallica yesterday. And I got like three Metallica stories today. But yeah, Murder in the Front Row, dude, is that new metal documentary that both of us really want to see.
Yeah.
It's about the Bay Area thrash metal bands. Of course, Metallica probably being the biggest of them, but we're talking Megadeth, Slayer, Anthrax, all the big four, you know, all those guys. Well, it was originally just screening in San Francisco in April, but now there's going to be screening dates in select cities across the United States, which is kind of weird. It's like it's almost like a tour. They've got full dates and everything like that, and it's going to be going through August and September. I was looking at some of these dates. Nothing here in Michigan, so we're still kind of SOL here, Meltdown. But
yeah, I've really gotten kind of into this Bay Area thrash scene, you know, just checking out some Testament recently.
Testament's
and of course,
great. Yeah,
you know,
Alex Stormy, great
music. Yeah, I mean, all those guys. Slayer.
Exodus. You just talked to Gary Holt a little while ago. You know?
Yeah, just been checking out a lot of that stuff and really getting into
Death Angel,
more and more.
Yeah. So a lot of great bands. That's really my wheelhouse, too. So
have you heard Death Angel's new record?
I haven't heard the new record, no.
I haven't heard it either. I wanted to check it out. But Mark from Death Angel is like, I met him once, and we like hit it off. I think he's one of those guys just hits it off with everybody.
Sure.
He's just a super good dude.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, you figure it's got to have a home release coming, you know, like a Blu-ray or digital or something. But right now it's these select screenings. But I got to see this movie.
And Metallica also going the way of, I don't want to say Kiss, but they're kind of venturing off in other things like children's books.
It's so bizarre. I mean, it's kind of cool. They've announced a children's ABC book. It has a dual purpose. It's supposed to help. It's geared toward children. It's supposed to help teach them the alphabet, but also while they're at it, some Metallica history.
Okay, well, always important.
All wrapped up into one, and that's supposed to be published in November.
Always important for your 5-year-olds. Let's face the facts here. It's not like Metallica needs any more money.
No. certainly after another report that we got to talk about here coming up. Metallica, among people like Guns N' Roses, both of them made Forbes' world highest paid celebrity list. Metallica came in. They were both in the top 100. Metallica, as a matter of fact, was number 30 on the Forbes list, earning $68.5 million.
And that's just within the last year, calendar year?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Guns N' Roses was down the list because they didn't play that many shows this past year. Yeah.
Number 71, they came in, $44 million for them. I assume that's like the entire band, like what the band grossed. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? The top rock band on the chart was actually the Eagles. They came in at number 8 with $100 million. Other notable musicians like Elton John, number 19. Billy Joel was on the list at 53. Jimmy Buffett at 57. Fleetwood Mac at 59. Paul McCartney was number 62. And the Rolling Stones were at number 83.
Yeah, once again, probably didn't play that many shows.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was cool to hear Geddy Lee talk about how he really wanted to get Paul McCartney in his book as well, because I mean legendary bass players, there you have it.
Sure.
And of course, Paul's not really thought of in the same vein as a Getty or a Les Claypool or something like that, but still nonetheless, as he was saying, really a master at his craft. Hey, speaking of guys like Paul McCartney and whatnot, I know you got some Woodstock 50, so just spit it out and be done with it and move on.
We've been covering it. I wanted to give the latest update and move on. Woodstock 50, the town for the new host site, has now denied the festival permit application.
Really? Really? Did that happen?
Dude, this thing is not destined to happen. Just give it up.
I mean, this is like the stupidest thing ever. It's like, first of all, what is this? Now the middle of July.
Yeah, it's becoming like the Spinal Tap of festivals.
Yeah, this is the Fire Fest.
It's a disaster.
Yeah, it's a Fire Fest.
So that's why I want to just move on. Throw that out there and let's move on.
Yeah, get to other stuff.
How about AC/DC?
Okay,
how's that?
Perfect, yeah.
First of all, Brian Johnson's got a TV show called A Life on the Road, and it is finally going to be, it was probably like an Australian thing, because it's finally going to premiere here in the United States coming up starting September 15th. Here's the weird thing, though. It's going to be on Access TV, so I'm not even sure where you might find that.
Yeah, no, it's Access TV is like on DirecTV and whatnot.
Is it on DirecTV?
Yeah,
okay.
But I think that he's done stuff before on Access TV, talking about his race cars.
And different
cars and vehicles and whatnot. So,
well, that's going to be premiering in the U.S. on Access TV September 15th. And as long as we're talking AC/DC, we've been hearing a lot about a possible tour, a lot of stuff about maybe a new album. Is Brian Johnson back in the band? This is a rumor. This is not confirmed, but there are rumors there may be some AC/DC tour announcements coming possibly as early as next week.
Yeah, I just saw that. That's cool, man. Well, we'll see what happens. You know, it's funny how, you know, last time they came through town with Brian Johnson, they played, you know, the stadium, right? Mm-hmm. And they come back through not that long, maybe a year later. I almost said a year later, and they played an arena, you know?
Right.
So Brian Johnson really pushes that band over the top.
Yeah, he really does.
You know, I mean, Axl's no slub for sure.
Right.
And I thought that show was actually pretty good. But Angus Young he just takes a bull by the horns as far as that's concerned. If you've never seen AC/DC play before, that's Angus's band.
Yeah, of course it is. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, and also, you're going to talk about M Shadows, yes, with Avenged Sevenfold. Yeah. So this is pretty cool. So let me get this straight. I should have got some of the E-Team guys down here.
Yeah,
from
probably.
But so let me get this straight. So you can unlock M Shadows in like a video game?
That's right. M Shadows, who is a big fan of the Call of Duty franchise, is now quite literally part of the video game.
Hold on. So he was like a fan, and all of a sudden he expunges his fandom or exposure or whatever it is, and then now he becomes like part of the game.
Yeah, which, I mean, we've seen a lot of stuff that Fortnite is huge. I don't really play it. My nephew's big into it, but that Fortnite, they've had in-game concerts with bands and stuff. The video game world's getting huge, but M Shadows, he recently took part in a stream about Black Ops 4, the latest installment of the Call of Duty franchise, and it was unveiled that he is now a playable character in the game.
That is pretty cool, and it does look just like him.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It does.
I've never really had a chance to meet M. Shadows, but somebody told me that we were partying one time down in Columbus, and he was with us. I don't remember that, though. I know that Sinister Gates was there.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, you must talk to him more, because I know you've talked to Avenged Sevenfold.
Oh, yeah, I've talked to him a bunch of times, and Zach, he's like kind of like an acquaintance of mine. Like, I can message him right now.
Sure.
Hit me right back. But it was funny, because someone just said that. I'm like, yeah, do you remember that time we were hanging out? It was Jericho and Sinister Gates and some of the other guys. This is kind of before I knew Zachy that much. And he was like, yeah, M. Shadows. I'm like, he was? Because he's always like been this like enigma. I've interviewed him before. He's great to talk to on the phone. But, it's kind of cool that he's got that.
Ooh,
game.
Look at Meltdown. He forgets hanging out with rock stars. what a big man you are.
I know. He had the short hair and stuff. I just thought he was somebody else, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
Ooh.
Oh, boy.
Ooh. All right. Just move on. Last thing. Here we go.
I got the last thing.
And then I'm done with you.
This is, I've been waiting. This was kind of weird. So, first of all, it was already weird. Blink-182 and Lil Wayne have been on tour together. already kind of a mismatched pair. I thought so when I found out about the tour. Well, at a recent show, it seems like Lil Wayne may have quit the tour while on stage. So he's up on stage, he's in the middle of performing a song, kind of stops and basically explains, this is not my crowd. I'm not used to performing. People were there to see Blink, not him. So it was their crowd he's performing
to. What do you mean it wasn't his crowd? They were in the audience.
Right.
Why couldn't he just play for them? What is he trying to say?
I mean, we're talking about a cross of genres here. So, but yeah, he basically says this might be my final show and then goes back into a song. I think we've got the audio
all right,
queued
let's
up.
Let's check out this muddy audio and see what it sounds
sure.
like.
I just want the people to know, if you wonder, please forgive me, but I am so not used to performing to a crowd and there's not too many, you know, like still form. That's not my swag. I'm not sure how long I'm going to be able to do this tour, but make some noise for Blink 182 for including me anyway. This might be my last night, though. Let's go.
Let's go. All right. There you have it.
This right
might,
back into it.
This might be my last night.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, there you go. Lil Wayne quit on stage.
You know, that's kind of a bummer. It's like, you know, I kind of like it sometimes when, you know, you get exposed to different things like that. And he's playing to a totally different crowd. Why not take that crowd and try to win them over instead of saying, well, I'm not used to playing to a crowd like this.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how the rest of the tour had been going, too. So I don't know. You know, I mean, sometimes it seems a little weird when you get like the same genre but different generations. Like, for example, Alice Cooper and Hailstorm. On tour
together,
you know,
yeah.
Like even that's like you're talking kind of a separation years, but at least that's the same. It's still rock music, you know. But like when you really Blink and Lil Wayne, that was a little out of a mix up. I thought.
Well, I think Lil Wayne's got to try to, like I said, he's got to try to win that crowd.
Win the crowd, yeah.
That would be my guess. You know, instead of saying, hey, I'm not used to playing, you know, to this kind of crowd. Well, try to win him over, dude.
Yeah, sure.
You know, do what you can.
Yeah.
Well, like you said, maybe the tour hadn't been going that well for him. Looked like there was a lot of people there.
Yeah.
You know, when he was playing.
Yeah.
So.
Must have been skateboarders there for the Blink 182.
All right. Well, give us your socials there.
Al Beck Radio, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
All right. At Meltdown WRIF. Thanks so much for checking out the podcast. I got some, as a matter of fact, we got a Riff Fest coming up this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to be taking a lot of these interviews I'm doing with like Shinedown and Seether, the guys from Pop Evil and Bad Flower, and putting them together for a podcast coming up next week. And I know I got a couple other ones already lined up for next week. But today with Geddy Lee was a pleasant surprise because I didn't know anything about this at this time yesterday.
Yeah.
So here we are. So, yeah, pretty cool. Once again, got to thank Nick and the guys from Rock City Music for helping me out with that. Hey, listen, thanks so much for checking out the podcast. If you like it, give it a 5-star rating, write a review, all that kind of things. Share it with your buddies. And like I said, keep checking back because we're doing this all the time right here. Talking Rock with Meltdown. Thanks so much for listening.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking 5 of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on 5 we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top 5? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.